Hello and welcome to the new podcast, Democracy In. This is the second episode of two, where I'm talking to John Layton and Nicola Sharratt about their feelings about democracy in the United Kingdom. So I got a couple of other like technical questions that I think are kind of interesting before I want to talk a bit more about stuff like trust and perception. And I want to come back to this point about Boris like upending social norms. Mm-hmm. But just in terms of a few technical things. So we've got, okay, unelected house, elected house. What triggers an election? Like, how do we know we're going to have an election? And who exactly are you electing? So Nicola, when you talked about you have a constituency, you go, you mark across, what are you marking across for?
I'm marking across for an individual who is part of a specific party. I presume that, can you elect an independent MP?
Yep. You can be independent, yeah.
So you're electing a person, not a party. So you're not
representing you.
Yeah.
Well, your constituency.
Yeah. So you're voting, you're not voting for Labour or Conservative, you're voting for Ms.
It's one of these weird ones where officially you're voting for the individual.
Yeah.
And you do see it because sometimes people will swap parties.
Yeah.
And when they swap parties, they don't have to re-stand for change elections. But in practice, people are voting for party.
So you're voting for a person.
Yes.
Who is meant to represent your voice. And in your constituency, right? You're to represent the interests of the people living in your area. Now, they happen to be a member of a political party as well. So in effect, people are voting for a party. Sometimes they might vote for an individual, but the system is set up that you're being, what you are choosing is somebody to be your representative.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. What makes a prime minister then? What are they head of?
They are, I believe, leader of the party that has the most MPs.
In the Houses of
Parliament. In the House of Commons, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think there's something that, and I'm interested in the way you think about this, this is something that some people in the US find surprising, is that you can change the prime minister without triggering an election.
Mm-hmm.
What's that about?
Well, my understanding is the prime minister, you know, it's all to do, right, with the branches of government here, right? That the presidency is its own, the executive is a distinct branch of government from the legislature here, right, in the US, okay. Right? Their houses,
yeah.
Whereas in the UK, the prime minister is just part of the same branch, essentially.
So the prime minister is just another person in the House of Parliament, in a sense, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's kind of how I would explain it, at least.
John, do you want to give it a go? What makes...
Yeah. So the Prime Minister, I think, again, I hope I'm right here, is the person who can command the confidence of the House. So
okay.
Basically, I think after you have an election, because they use the first-past-the-post system in the UK, you end up with parties get more seats than the actual number of votes they get. So, for example, if you've got a constituency where you've got three people standing,
mm-hmm.
one person gets 40%, one person gets 30, one person gets 20, and a few candidates get anything else, the person mm-hmm. who got 40% will get the seat.
Right.
So, if you replicate that across the country, mm-hmm. so we think the current government's got a majority of, I think, 58 seats out of 630. You know, so they've got about 100 seats more than the nearest next party, despite only getting about 40-something percent of the vote. So,
right. I think that's going to be interesting when we look at other countries that have different systems. Yeah.
Yeah. So, the bigger parties tend to get disproportionately more seats. So you mm-hmm. tend to get more stable majorities.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that, the party that got the majority, you have a confidence vote. And as long as they can get a confidence vote, they become prime minister.
So we as people, voters, we vote for somebody to represent us. You take like who gets the most votes in each constituency, right? And that person is then sent to parliament to represent us. When they get to parliament, you count up, they all decide which party they're in. You count up which party has the most representatives in it, right? And then whichever one has the majority, the most representatives, they decide amongst themselves who is going to lead them. And that becomes the prime minister.
Effectively, yeah. Yes. Although, yeah, the only time you get a slight nuance is if you don't have someone with an absolute majority.
Yeah.
Then they'll try and form a coalition. So I had that a few years ago where the Tory, the Conservatives were slightly underneath the majority they needed, so the Lib Dems went with them. And then then that gave them the confidence they needed. So they could win the confidence vote in Parliament. So you'd say more than half the people in Parliament mm-hmm. had confidence in the government. They became the government.
So I think this is where we get into what is up with Boris. Like, because I had been opening my Guardian website every day for the last couple of months, expecting to see that Boris Johnson has resigned. Let's talk about how do you actually get someone to resign? How do you get somebody to step down?
It's hard.
Yeah.
But also, again, this comes back to, because we have an unwritten constitution, uh-huh. it's based on the good chap principle. We've yeah. never had someone who's not a good chap mm-hmm. until now. Now we've got someone who's not a good chap. It's really hard.
Yeah.
The only people really can get through are the Tories.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'll see how the by-election goes tomorrow. If they do as badly as is expected, a bit more pressure might come.
How damaged do you think he was, John, by a few weeks ago, by that confidence vote, right? Because he did badly. I mean, he survived it, right? But he did do well.
I mean, you look at the polling, and the polling for the Conservative vote is horrendous. It's really bad.
By polling, you mean opinion polls across the whole country, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so the opinion polling, basically by pretty much anything you look at, the focus group results, opinion mm-hmm. polls, the Conservatives doing very badly on trust. But also, it's what this is where you talk to my friends. When I talk to my friends about it, okay, I come from a fairly liberal background. But even my friends who are less like that, people you'd expect to be conservative, mm-hmm. are slagging off, and not slagging off a little bit. It's because there's that just complete lack of decency.
Yeah, so I think there is this interesting thing that it seems what gets somebody to resign is kind of this agreement that he no longer, or she, has the confidence of the people who are in the Houses of Parliament.
Depends. So mm-hmm. so actually, if you're getting rid of a Prime Minister mid-term, mm-hmm. so like with Boris Johnson at the moment, or Theresa May before him, mm-hmm. it's this thing where the Conservatives MPs have mm-hmm. a vote about whether they have confidence in him. Mm-hmm. And actually, the last few versions where they did this, even though each time the Prime Minister won the vote,
yeah,
it was so damaging, actually they're out within 6 months.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the same thing with Johnson. Most people are saying, even for him, he'll be out within 6 months.
But it's like the people who decide that he's out or not out. It's not like you have an election of the people. It's like who he actually leads is he leads members of parliament. And it's the members of parliament who have to decide whether he stays in or out, in a sense.
Yep.
Yeah. How often do we have elections in the UK, general elections, and what triggers them?
5 years at most, is it?
Yeah. So it's just changed. Mr. Johnson, the Prime Minister, can go to the Queen and say, I'm having an election, please.
Right.
And they have an election.
Yeah.
But there's still a limit, right? Isn't there?
Yeah, so there's a time limit. It's at most 5 years, I think.
Because
yeah.
I thought it used to be that there wasn't a time limit.
There's always,
I always thought it was 5 years, isn't
there? Okay. So they could pull it earlier. Yeah, they've always been able to shorten it, but there's always a cutoff, which I think at the moment is bloody 2 years away. Not that we're counting.
Yeah.
It's ages.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, it's...
Me and Mary might have our votes back by then, at this point.
I hope so. That would be nice, wouldn't it? So I think one of the things we've kind of been skirting around through this conversation is the question of like trust and perception. We talked about how could you make somebody like Boris resign? And I get the sense from what you're saying, John, and a little bit from what I've been reading as well from a distance, that people really feel like stuff is changing right now, like norms are being broken. But it's interesting to me, like, do you feel that people are more hopeless about the state of democracy in the UK than they used to be?
I don't think it's people are hopeless about the state of democracy. I think they're just hopeless about the utter incompetence of the current the current guy in charge, and because he is useless, he surrounded himself by useless people. Mm-hmm. So, when you look at the Brexit deal that's been done, which is the worst one you could possibly do, and then you look at how things have been done with you know, COVID, which wasn't particularly good. And then you look at the reaction to, you know, there is no policies you can think of at the moment with the current government.
Yeah.
Which are good. But actually but I think the difference being here, maybe most people I know of aren't blaming politics, they're blaming Boris and the current Conservatives.
Okay, so it's not like there's a sense of despair about the state of the country in general. Like, we don't have a democratic system. It's more like these particular people are messing things up. But do you think that if you had a different party in power, things could go back to how they used to be?
You'd hope so.
Yeah.
But okay, you know, for me, it's the first time I've wondered, you know, started to think genuinely about, you know, should we start to have constitutional reform? Because this is... the whole thing in the past, it's like, just like I said with the House of Lords a bit earlier, it's in the past, it's always just about work. You know, it's worked. Yeah. It's everyone looks and goes, this is bonkers. You wouldn't design it like this, but it works.
Yeah.
And now we've had someone who's showing that actually it doesn't. You have to have those formal checks and balances.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you have someone like Johnson.
Yeah. To keep someone in check. Nikki, I'm going to ask you, what do you think people complain about in the UK in terms of their politicians? What do we consider a scandal?
I think it's all relative. I don't know in terms of what we consider a scandal, but I feel when I read the newspaper, like The Guardian, whatever, newspaper from home, if I talk to my family, right, my brother lives in Germany, so there's sometimes kind of interesting conversations, right, because, and my mum's a US citizen, right, so the generally my family's always been interested in, like, politics broadly, right?
Yeah.
I still sometimes feel, and again, I think this is about living where I do when I do.
Mm-hmm.
Part of me always feels like you think you've got it bad. You think that's a scandal, right? You think that, and I entirely hear John, right? And, you know, absolutely, right? Boris is a freaking nightmare and incompetent and awful. But then I also sit here and I think, well, they just passed, you know, a law that means kids can bring a gun into my classroom, or, you know, they're openly racist. Some of the, like, a number of politicians in the state are just, like, openly racist, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or, as you said earlier, you know, people had to stand in a queue for 10 hours to vote and nobody's allowed to bring them water because that's now against the law.
Right.
So I feel there's just like this, it's the scales, right? It's just different scales. And they always have been different scales, but I still sometimes look at that incompetence of Boris and it's infuriating, but it's almost comforting.
Because, but I suppose the difference, you know,
which is totally an outsider perspective at this point, right? But I just feel like the scales are different. Like, what is a scandal? And it should be a scandal, right? Like, Boris should be out. But I'm not terrified in the same way I am by the politics here.
So, Nicola, you'll recognise this feeling. When in the UK they were having the scandal over MPs' expenses, which was, it was found out, you know, MPs get an allowance to spend on setting up a second home in London so that they can be both in their constituency and live in London because they come back and forward so often, right? And it was found that the expenses that they were getting paid for their second houses in London or vice versa were somewhat exaggerated. And one of the hilarious examples was somebody had had a duck house built, right?
Remember the duck house, yeah.
Right, and I was thinking at around the same time, I mean, was it like the third Illinois governor had just been sent to prison?
To jail, yes.
Blagojevich, right, for like out and out bribes, like being recorded. And I was just like, you know, I'm kind of proud of us that duck houses is the thing that we're incensed about, as opposed to out and out bribes, like the third governor sent to jail for corruption, and we're just rolling our eyes and making jokes about it. But it's something. On the one hand, I think, okay, this is good because you're holding people to account for the small things, which will hopefully stop the bigger things coming. But on the other hand, sometimes I think it's like whipping up a sense of outrage without necessarily there being much substance to it, just to make a point.
I think the thing that's scary at the moment, though, is that it's getting more to what, so in the past, the corruption scandal was, as you said, someone claimed lots of expenses because the salary was pretty low.
Yeah.
So that was just what they did. And then someone decided that wasn't good enough. Yeah, you know, you get the occasional guy who's a big corrupt. But the stuff recently is a lot more overt. So suddenly you're finding out the prime minister keeps on trying to get giving government money to his mistresses.
Right.
You've got people slipping donations to Tory party donors, and suddenly they're getting PPE contracts for hundreds of millions of dollars worth of useless stuff. Yeah, you know, so the old, oh, they're a bit dodgy, or yeah, they might be a bit, you know, casual with some of the stuff they say, fine. But now it's you can see it heading down that US route, particularly with the conservatives. That's what's scary.
Well, I wonder partly why I kind of rolled my eyes at the DuckHouse kind of stuff is a little bit because I wonder if that kind of hilarious headline generating scandal distracts from just the day-to-day way that things get done when only a small group of people from a particular social class who all happen to be buddies have power at every level, right? Across government, but also across institutions and in financial institutions, etc. Stuff that you don't necessarily call corruption, but if you looked at it from a different angle, you probably could. Right. It's just it happens that the same people always get the same kind of contracts, or the financial system is organized in such a way that it benefits particular people, right? Or offshore banking, all this kind of stuff. And by focusing on these kind of theatrical things that can generate a lot of outrage and hilarious headlines, you're not really paying attention to the bigger structures, which are ones of patronage. And only now with Boris is that becoming so overt, right, that there's this revolving doors of consultants and so on.
But it's not even revolving door of consultants now. Now it is just out and out corruption of, you know, I want to give my girlfriend a job because I want to pay for her.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to give Tory donors money and contracts. I think it's much more poisonous now than it was. But in the past it was, you know, a bit, I went to Oxford with this guy and did PPE, so, you know, we're getting a job because I know him. That's the difference that you might not have picked up having not been here for a few years, it's a lot more toxic. And also you're starting to see trying to force identity politics into the UK, which has never really been there. So the Rwanda policy is a perfect example, but actually among the people that Tory vote, you know, hardcore Tory voters, it's really popular.
When you say identity politics, you mean making things explicitly racist?
Yeah, trying to find wedge items to push. You know, trans rights. You know, trans just isn't a thing in the UK. No one cares about it, apart from Boris Johnson trying to raise it all the time with, you know, raise it as a part of it. The Rwanda policy is designed to piss off people like me.
Right.
And it works really well. It makes me really angry because it's cool. That's never really been a thing in UK politics, certainly not in the time that I've been around.
Yeah.
And that's part of it. So it's not just that it's becoming, you know, you could see it becoming more Americanized. It's becoming more corrupt. It's becoming people holding power just for the sake of holding power. Because look, they've got all this power. They do nothing with it.
Right. Yeah.
Apart from trying to keep Boris Johnson as prime minister.
I do want to move on because there's one sort of other section that I think will be maybe a little bit more optimistic to get through before we finish.
I'm all out of optimism, Mary.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, Nick.
I should have changed the order. I should have done the optimistic stuff.
To believe that was before we started this conversation. It's hard to...
Sorry. Yeah.
You choosing not to follow UK politics because you've had enough of US. I mean, I'm a nerd of this stuff, and I'm switching off.
I know.
I'm getting to the point where I've stopped listening to the BBC, Radio 4 in the morning, which is the news programme. I listened to it for pretty much all my adult life until about 2 years ago, and I finally couldn't cope with it anymore.
Well, we are going to come to the topic of the BBC because one of the things I want to think about is what is it that makes democracy work beyond just the elections, right? So, Nick, you and I know that, for instance, if you are in Peru or Bolivia, strikes are really blockades, right? Mm-hmm. So people come down from the mountains or come from the field and like put rocks across the road and block the entire road system demanding change. So strikes and blockades are a really big part of democratic participation in countries in South America. I'm really interested in the strikes that are happening right now in the UK. We are recording this on the week when a big rail strike just started, and there are other strikes of barristers and doctors and medical workers and so on that are sort of threatened, and teachers. But there's also like the press and the role of newspapers and the BBC in terms of creating debate about a topic that actually affects what people do in government position, right? Affects laws. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you see as that kind of relationship, if you see one that's different maybe from other places.
I think that there's, from my perspective, actually, that I still have some of that maybe residual nostalgia for the BBC. You know, I still want to really trust it to be relatively neutral and objective. Mm-hmm. And then I talk to my dad, who is old school, borderline Marxist socialist, right? And he's pretty angry about the BBC, right? Increasingly, right? About them towing a party line, mm-hmm. or, you know, not kind of pushing back on, especially Boris's positions on, you know.
Yeah.
And so I'm a bit conflicted by it. You know, I actually do still, you know, John said, like, it's really hard to keep listening to, because it's just so depressing sometimes. I do still fairly frequently listen to, like, Radio 4's PM show, mm-hmm. sometimes to some of the other shows on it. And there's part of me in it that, like, really deeply wants to trust it because of the nature of it compared to the way in which big media outlets are set up, especially here. Mm-hmm. But just doesn't trust much of anything at the moment.
Yeah, interesting. Let me interrupt a minute, because I want to think about how do things, like, do things actually get changed? Do laws actually get passed? Like, I mean, this sounds like a ridiculous question, but it's actually a really important one. Like, do you believe that laws actually get passed? Like, they might be...
Yeah, you definitely don't have the gridlock you've got in the US. Right. So,
and I think it seems to me that there is a role of the media in doing that. Like, say there's an issue that you care about, like the cost of living crisis, right, that we're going through right now. Like, people report about it in the newspapers. Yep. Like, public figures speak out. So, like, Jack Monro, who's the anti-poverty campaigner, will make a statement or do something, and it gets reported in the newspapers, and then it gets discussed by a politician, and it gets discussed in the House of Commons. And there's, like, this relationship where maybe not you or I could get an issue that would be taken up enough that a law would change. But things change, and like the media has a role to play in amplifying conversations or bringing, like, journalists bring attention to the particular things, and politicians react to what journalists say.
Well, I suppose, yeah, there was a good example of that with the Partygate, so all right. The Partygate stuff, that was a couple of journalists, I think, The Mirror. Mm-hmm. Just digging and digging and digging and digging.
Right.
And I know it was always ITV News as well, wasn't it? ITV News and The Mirror, mm-hmm. both digging away like crazy. And they mm-hmm. got it. They found people who would talk about it, and they corroborated it. And it's caused this big scandal. Yeah, massive right. scandal. It's going to have an impact. Mm-hmm. I can think of a pressure, actually, there's a pressure group called Pregnant Then Screwed or something. Pregnant mm-hmm. Then Screwed, which is about what happens to women after they've had kids and the right. problems with getting fired in pregnancy or not having it.
Yes.
It happens to be, I found out when I was sharing something that they released on Facebook, it turned out a friend of mine knows the woman who founded it. She got pregnant, got fired from her job, got really pissed off about it, started this pressure group, and it's starting to build up this change in law, and you kind of get yeah. these things. And now it's become this really great big pressure group, and you regularly see that campaign group get talked mm-hmm. about. I always like it because I know from my friend.
I was thinking about, I can't remember what her name is right now, which is not a good sign, right? But the woman who, like, led the campaign to stop upskirting, and she was pretty young, right? And she did, but she, like, did manage to make this big media campaign about it, and she yeah. did get the law passed. So I think actually, you know, sometimes even you or me kind of thing.
Yes.
There is that potential.
So it sounds like both of you sort of agree with me in the sense that there does seem to be avenues, even though we're slightly amazed that they work, where somebody can make a change. Like, you can mm-hmm. say, okay, for instance, upskirting is a really terrible thing. I'm going to dedicate my next 5 years of my life to campaigning for this. And through a combination of engaging with media and talking to politicians and talking to people, things can actually change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, the despair comes from just the current incumbent.
Indeed.
And the people who surround him. And but generally, before that, and hopefully whoever replaces him, generally, as I said, it works. No one's sure why, but it works.
So do you think there are other institutions or organizations that are involved in getting things done? So, for instance, in some countries, the military is very involved in politics. So, Nicola, you've had, I think, maybe more experience in Latin America, where there's a very different relationship between the military and democracy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sometimes a really frightening one, right?
I
just to segue away from the military for a minute, and I don't know how much this holds weight anymore, but I have, since I moved to the US and have been in or worked in higher education the whole time and came straight from undergrad in the UK, it really struck me, especially when I was first here, was the importance of student politics and student mobilizing in the UK that I, for the most part, did not see in the US, right? And so I remember, and I imagine it was similar for you both, right? I remember being an undergrad and going on marches all the time about all kinds of things, right? And seeing those as an important mechanism for activism, for change, for like. My sense has been it's only in the past couple of years in the US that has become something that student, you know, undergrads are really involved in. And often I talk to my friends who are my age, right, 40-ish in the US who have grown up here, and they've suddenly discovered protests. And like, they're all into it. And that's great. I'm glad they're doing it. But it's like this new thing for them.
Yeah.
And then I look at my undergrads who are about 20, and especially in Atlanta, right, especially with the last few years, they are now out on the street. So I think that that, to me, has always been a difference that is perhaps now changing in terms of participation or another form, you know, another mechanism, right? And again, I realize that if it's student-based and university-based, it's exclusive. There's only a certain number of people participating in the UK, right? But that always really struck me as a difference in how national politics happened, right? That students collectively and nationally could be mobilized in a way they weren't here.
I might ask, Nick, what university did you go to?
I was at Cambridge. I realize that this is not university.
Exactly, because I was at Manchester, which is still a very good university, and I was very heavily involved with the student union. But outside my student union friends, no one did anything.
There's a student union. I think this is...
A student union. It's
I think this
is
the thing that Nicola's pointing out, that I think is the perspective you get from having gone elsewhere and seeing what's missing elsewhere from what you expect. So, for instance, if you're in Latin America and you look at the UK, you're like, where's the military, right? And I think what, Nikki, you're pointing out, and I totally 100% agree with you, is the thing that the UK has that we take for granted that we don't see elsewhere is student politics as well. And I think there's other things like we've talked about the media having a role. There isn't, for instance, any kind of organized crime heavy involvement. Like, we don't deal with mafia in the UK. We don't deal with military involvement. We do have trade unions, not as much as Europe, but certainly much more than elsewhere, right? So there are these different elements that act as pressure groups and have a voice, even if you're not voting for them. So democracy consists of these other areas that are part of the conversation.
I suppose maybe the thing that might be, because you're both a couple of years younger than me, that, that I think the student fees protest became bigger than that. Because I think when I was involved with the student union, we had a bit of that. And because I think I was the last year that got a grant.
Because both Nicola and I were at that really pivotal moment of student fees being introduced and the Iraq War.
Yeah, exactly. Those are the big things I remember. I remember like sitting on bridges in London, right? And my brother's 7 years younger. And so he was in uni when the fees kept getting racketed up. Mm-hmm. And I do remember them being very active and very out there. But I hear you, John, right, that it's not widespread, but just the complete absence of student unions or student kind of political organizing that isn't, say, about, to use the phrase, identity politics, is really striking here. The other difference, Mary, and this is something that I see much more in the South than I ever did till I moved down here, that I don't see in the UK or in perhaps as much other parts of the US, is religion, right? Which we touched on earlier.
Yeah.
But religion is such an organizing political force here. You know, one of our senators is, you know, the preacher at Ebenezer Baptist at MLK's church, right? I mean, and I really struggled to wrap my head around it. Like, I was like, I really like this man, I want to vote for him, but I'm really troubled by the idea of somebody who's currently a religious leader,
yeah,
being an elected official as well. So that even regionally is something weird, but I feel like that's absent from the UK.
Well,
right?
I think that comes back to the things we were talking about, of things that we value our indifference to, right? That they're there, but they're there and we don't want to look at them or think about them. And that's what makes them good. Like, that's what makes them acceptable and useful. Religion is part of the state in the UK, but it never really has any power, in contrast to here, but the complete flip here in the US, right? And so you're right that that's a really interesting distinction, that like the fact we don't have religious groups getting involved in local or national politics in the UK is interesting, right?
Or where they do, it's very notable. So again, the Rwanda thing, there's all the archbishops for the Church of England have written a joint letter saying that it's disgraceful.
Yeah.
Again, the Conservative Party was supposed to be the party of the Church of England.
Exactly.
Are very upset about the fact that the bishops are telling them they shouldn't do moral things.
Well, guys, I've got two last questions for you before we finished. One, what does democracy mean to you? Do you live in a democracy in the UK?
Yes, it's not perfect. There's things you could do to make it better, but there's a lot. As I said, I've lived in countries, one of which was democratic and one of which wasn't, and I'd rather be here. Mm-hmm. I am. You know, I lived there. I didn't like it. I came back. You know, you look at other countries and, you know, there's things I change. Some of the apathy and this first past the post system, you'd want to change it. But as I said, up until Johnson, it worked. You have a party for a few years and then there's a change and then they do some things, and generally it never gets too extreme.
Yeah.
It's kind of worked.
Okay. So, Nicola, what about you? What does democracy mean to you in the UK? Does the UK have a democracy?
I think it does. I mean, I think there are individual parts of it that are not democratic, right? Yeah. You know, hereditary power and so forth, or hereditary positions, rather. But overall, yeah, I think it is. Yeah. And the unwritten, you know, the lack of a written constitution is always an interesting one, right? Because it makes room for people to not be a good chap, to use John's phrase, right? But it also builds in perhaps a degree of flexibility that perhaps there is an advantage to that. I don't know, but I think sometimes when I hear people harken back to like constitutional originality in the US, and it's like, well, constitutional originality means you only get to vote if you're a white man and you own property or something, right? I mean, so I don't know. To be honest, the no written constitution is about the only thing I really do remember from AS level politics. So that one has stuck with me.
Okay, and my last question, what is either your best or your worst or the weirdest thing about the system in our country?
Or the weirdest is when you have the elections with the weird candidates. So when you have the Monster Raven. My favourite ever one was my first election. You had the Miss Moneypenny party, which was a nightclub in. They had this massive like drag queen with huge heels, with ginormous balloon-like nipples with flashing lights on the end of it, standing behind the guy who just lost his seat in a scandal. And you've got Miss Moneypenny with the drag queen with these lovely flashing nipples standing behind him. And this is 1997, so 25 years ago, you really didn't have stuff like this. So you get some very odd characters. Or there's Count Binface, who always stands in London, and he's got a cape and he has a giant pedal bin on his head.
And the Monster Raving Loony Party, of course. Yeah, I completely forgot about when my husband Joe was watching some election thing with me once and was like, what the hell is that? Nicola, what's your weirdest thing about the system in the UK?
It's not as weird as John's, but I mean, and I know that this is like going back to stuff we talked about ages about with the Queen, but the fact that she gives her speech about what the government is going to do, and she refers to my government. Like,
yes.
I still always trip up a little bit when I hear that, like, because it reminds me of the weirdness of the system, right?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like that actually the government only exists at the
discretion
of the Queen, right? That's fantastic. Thank you both so much. This has been really interesting. I really appreciate you taking the time to share your opinions with me and ask some weird questions about democracy in our country.
And that is all we have time for today. So thank you so much for listening to these first two pilot episodes about the United Kingdom. Look out for our next episode, which is going to be about democracy in Mexico. And that, I think, is going to be another extremely interesting conversation.